Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The Alberta Research Council has a defense contract, and that's to set up a new manual incorporating environmentally sound practices into the armed forces protocols for dealing with pests. And now that winter's here, what better time to market the frost-free nose pump? It's for cows, and it's made on a ranch near Rimby, Alberta. As well, the Alberta Conservation Association has launched its new magazine, and it's called Conservation. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. When the Department of National Defense was looking for someone to upgrade its manual on pest management, the Alberta Research Council was quick to step up to the plate. Dr. Paul Sharma manages the Integrated Pest Management Unit at the Alberta Research Council. It's his job to put an environmentally friendly twist on the military's new handbook.
Integrated pest management is where we use various approaches, be it chemicals, biological, cultural methods to control various pests.
Now, why was the National Defense Department interested in upgrading their manual?
The department is responsible for protecting the health of its personnel and also protecting the integrity of these their facilities at the land bases in Canada and overseas also.
What part did you have to look after?
Okay, we have to look after. There are 9 chapters in this IPM manual. The manual was revised last time in 1993, and it was written originally in 1981. And since that time, a number of things have changed in the technology. The new technology has come and so on, and the new issues have come up. So what we have to do is there are 9 chapters, as I mentioned, and we have to revise each of those chapters. So in this project, I have various experts in each of their areas which will be putting this manual together.
Now, you say that there's been a number of changes in the last few years. What might some of those changes be?
Well, some of the changes which are happening is that more emphasis is on the biological control methods, the cultural control methods, rather than relying solely on the chemicals. Back in 60s, 70s, and even early 80s, the emphasis was more on use the chemical and get away with it. These days, if you look, because of the environmental concerns, the public safety, and so on, the people are more interested in natural means of controlling pests. Or it's really managing the pests in a way which is environmentally friendly.
What would be some of the special concerns from the perspective of the National Defense Department? Where would they be using this sort of management?
This is at their land bases, the air bases, and sometimes the naval facilities also may have problems. The department has on these bases a lot of property. Even it could be turf grasses on golf courses or their housing projects and their grounds. So landscape grounds. So in various means, that's where the control of these pests is required. And in some cases, there are vertebrate pests, birds and other pests which are required to be controlled.
You've been looking at things from the plant side. Give me some examples of some of the things that you've suggested.
Well, in plant science, say, for example, vegetation management, there are a number of noxious weeds which can be on their property. How to manage those weeds is very important because these weeds can also cause problems on adjacent farming field or farming community. And the use of pesticides, for example, in many of these grounds, in turf, in various plant escapes is not recommended really. And that's why we have to look into that. We try to use the best technology which is environmentally friendly.
What would be some of those target plants?
Some of these plants will be invasive plants. Some of these species will occur on roadside for brush control. In some of the properties occur, for example, willows, pine, poplars, that type of thing, wild rose. There are other weedy species, for example, leafy spurge, burdock, poison ivy, thistles, those type of species control.
So what would you actually do in order to control them?
Well, there are different methods to control. One is, for example, I mentioned chemical use, but that's because of the restrictions, it's least recommended. The other methods could be biological control, and biological control can be using insects, which can chew on the plants. There could be some biological control methods, which will be based on microorganisms, where it can be formulated into products they can be used. There could be some other cultural methods, for example, simply mowing or burning, that type of examples.
Is there a concern with, say, the movement of military equipment, that it might take weed seeds into areas that they hadn't been if they were moving equipment around or they've been on military exercises?
Right. There is a concern with moving various pests through the movement of their vehicles, even the aircraft. And so we have to recommend how to clean the equipment for weed infestations if they are carried through them, or sometimes the insect pests which can be carried. And we have to make recommendations on how to disinfect these vehicles and so on.
So if you think of the Canadians being over in Afghanistan, for example, and then coming back here, are there concerns there?
Yeah, there are concerns because in being a tropical climate in those countries, sometimes new pests can come with the equipment. So the disinfection of the equipment, the vehicles and so on is very, very important. And complete cleaning for any infestation from weed seeds and those type of things is important, because we do not want to bring any exotic or new pests into the country. Once they are within Canada, it becomes a big problem. So we have to make sure that these vehicles and equipment are clean.
What's new about some of these things that are coming up? It seems like a very dynamic field.
It is a dynamic field, and Alberta Research Council actually is considered one of the leaders in developing methods for integrated pest management. We have a history of about 20 years in this field, and experts in the insect pest control, the plant disease control, the weed and vegetation management, invertebrate pest control. So we are considered a sort of a national center of national reputation in this area.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was Paul Sharma, manager of the Integrated Pest Management Unit at the Alberta Research Council. Looking after the chapter on wildlife pest management is Larry Roy. He's with the Sustainable Ecosystem Business Unit at the ARC.
Take, for instance, say beaver. If you have a beaver that's coming into your the area around your barracks and cutting down your trees, well, that's a problem. So you have to solve that problem. Another example would be to deal with, say, if you had an airbase and you had a lot of birds around that airbase, and a possibility of contacting those birds with the airplanes, and of course it could lead to some very serious problems. So.
What about other rodents?
We have problems with mice. There's problems if you're out east, not in Alberta. You have problems with rats. There's problems with Richardson's ground squirrels, for instance. There's a whole list of species that, and also I did say birds and mammals, but there's also reptiles as well. So you can have some problems with some poisonous snakes, for instance, if you're down in Suffield. So there's a wide variety of animals that cause problems. So.
What are you suggesting then in terms of controlling them?
Well, in terms of controlling them, first of all, is you have to find out why they're there. I mean, are they there because you've set out an attractant to them? So, I mean, that might lead you to an approach of how to handle the problem. For instance, if you're talking about beaver and you've got, a major pond that's right beside your airbase, you're going to have problems with those beaver coming over and cutting your trees. So you might want to change the shape of the pond or the location of the trees so that it's a certain distance away from the pond so that they wouldn't bother your trees, as opposed to the old approach of just taking the gun out and shooting those beaver.
How about snakes?
Snakes are, again, there's poisonous snakes is if you don't have the places that harbor what snakes are after. So snakes are after, of course, food. If they're after mice, for instance, if you have no harboring for mice, you have a very low population, you won't have the snakes go there. If you don't have the cover for them where they can stay in the shade and so on, then you won't have them around. So it's a matter of controlling their environment.
You've been working at this for quite some time. How has this whole notion of integrated pest management, from your perspective, how have things changed over time?
Well, I've been working with problem wildlife for 25 years now, and I guess in the old days, it was shoot first and ask questions later, and now it's ask questions first, and the last resort is the shooting. And we still, despite the fact that we have all these new repellents and aversive agents and control of the environment, we still end up having to do some control of animals, but it's the last resort. You know, and the idea is, there's always been a problem with when you move an animal, and you know, a lot of people say just move the animal somewhere else. The only thing is, when you're moving that animal somewhere else, usually it's a death sentence for that animal. So basically what you want to do is control the environment so you're not going to keep on attracting animals, and then you still may end up having to, like I said, as a last resort, to remove the animals that are there at the moment that are causing the problem.
Since it's the military that's come to you and asked you to help them with this and to rewrite the manual, what has it been like for you working with them in terms of acceptance of these ideas?
The ideas were generated from them. They wanted to a more integrated approach, and so it just fit in perfect with our philosophy nowadays, and they were right on side and right up to date. So,
thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was Larry Roy, manager of the Sustainable Ecosystem Business Unit at the Alberta Research Council. I also spoke with Dr. Paul Sharma of the ARC's Integrated Pest Management Unit. Winter can be a hard time for watering cattle. Dugouts freeze up and solar-powered pumps power out because of shorter days. And with gas and electrical charges going through the roof, farmers are looking for cheaper alternatives to water their cattle. That's where Jim and Jackie Anderson come in. For the last 4 years, this ranching couple from Rimby have been perfecting and marketing a handy little pump that they call the Frost-Free Nose Pump.
Take one step back carefully, Cheryl, because there's a big cow pirate.
Oh yeah, I see what you mean.
During the summer, I traveled to their farm near Rimby, and with Jackie making sure that I didn't step in any cow pies, I got up close and personal with their cows, so I could see the Frost-Free Nose Pump in action.
Well, it's a very old technology. It's basically the old-fashioned hand pump with a downhole cylinder, and we usually hang that cylinder in the neighborhood of 10 feet from the surface. That's subject to depending on the water table within that culvert. But in most cases, it's 10 feet is adequate. And when the cattle push on that pendulum, they're basically doing the same thing as the handle did on the old-fashioned well.
Why do you call this a frost-free pump?
Well, we call it a frost-free nose pump because it will not freeze in the wintertime. Of course, it works in the summer too, but the real attraction to this nose pump is it does not freeze up in the wintertime, and we still don't require energy of any form to achieve that. Electricity or natural gas or heat of any source, what we're depending on is the geothermal heat to keep the water temperature just slightly above freezing, and we're able to achieve that just with some of the principles that we've come up with the installation.
What do you do? Do you have to go down very deep?
Well, we like to see a deep culvert vertically in the ground to capture what we're after is the geothermal heat. And with our experience so far, we find that a 7-meter culvert, which is 23 feet, if we can sink that in the ground vertically, the whole thing except for 2 feet above ground. And we like to see no smaller than a 24-inch diameter culvert. And then we insulate that culvert. We show people how to insulate that culvert. And, of course, we have a drain hole in there as another source of defense against freeze-up so that when the cattle are not pumping this, the top 5 feet of that pipe is empty. And the other things that we do is a cement pad around there to prevent the compaction from driving the frost deeper. And we even encourage people to lay styrofoam around the culvert, again, in an effort to keep the frost from going so deep. And then our last is a little detail about how to pour cement up against the steel culvert. We want a frost break at that point, as well as a water seal. And all of this stuff is low-tech stuff, user-friendly, You know, it's not a sophisticated system, and most of this stuff can be done in on the site and without elaborate equipment, and fairly low cost too.
Where did you get the idea? How many sleepless nights did you have?
Well, the original concept came from a friend of ours, and we've worked with along with him, and he has since deceased, and we have just taken the frost-free aspect and refined it. We worked with the Alberta Research Council on this project for a year, using one of their engineers, just to fine-tune the whole design, the whole mechanical thing. And the rest of that is just kind of come up with common sense ideas about insulation, geothermal heat, frost breaks, and the whole thing is motivated by not having a need for electricity on site. That really opens up a whole bunch of new management opportunities for ranchers and cattle owners as far as grazing remote areas, or even especially drawing water from a dugout without the need or limitation of electricity.
How would you do that with a dugout?
Well, the dugout installation is really an attractive installation, and I really encourage people with dugouts to do this, because with the use of a frost-free nose pump along the side of a dugout, you can make that dugout become a year-round watering source without being limited by electricity, without having to chop ice in the wintertime, and without risk of getting cattle out on that ice to access the water below the ice. And quite simply, all we do in a dugout installation is you trench a line from the floor of that dugout to wherever you want to locate the frost-free nose pump. The water flows through that line from the floor of the dugout into the culvert, and the nose pump simply lifts the water up the culvert, up from below from the bottom of the culvert. And the only energy required is sponsored by the cow. If she wants a drink of water, she pushes on the pendulum with her nose.
How hard is it to push?
Well, the one that we're looking at right now, it is a 40-foot well. The static water level is at 20 feet below surface, and this measures 65 pounds. So it takes 65 pounds on that pendulum to move the pendulum and produce water. We have another installation that we look at, and we had to go 20 feet to access water there, and the water came within 10 feet of surface in that installation, and that one only takes 35 pounds to move that pendulum. And so it's there's a direct relationship. The force required to move the pendulum is dependent on how much vertical lift that you're making the cows do.
Well, I know I might have trouble with my nose, but looking at the size of those cows, I don't think they'd have any trouble.
Well, and that's one thing we have to remind people. I mean, we encourage people to come and look at these nose pumps and, you know, push them and kick them and whatever. And invariably, people go up to the thing and push it and say, ooh, that's a pretty hard push. But I have to remind people that we're not watering people. We're watering 1,400-pound cows that have a neck on them the size of your body. They got 4 feet in the ground and 1,400 pounds behind them. And so what we as humans consider a hard push for a cow is just a piece of cake.
Well, I'm just looking at Jackie here. She's having a twirl at it.
Well, it does depend where she's pushing on the high point of that black plate there. If she pushed on the low end of it, it makes a big difference. And it's a physical pump. It's strictly physics in this pump. And the way we have that built, that pendulum is a 2-to-1 mechanical advantage. And we have a 2-position hole in the hood there. We can improve the mechanical advantage from 2-to-1 to 3-to-1, which will reduce the power it takes to swing the pendulum. And in some instances, we encourage people to start their cows on that because it is easier for a cow to push and therefore easier for them to learn it. And then once they've learned that, oh, to get a drink of water, all I have to do is push that black plate, then you can return that swivel point to the front position, because the problem with the back position is it is a softer push, but it yields less water per stroke. So on the front position, for every stroke, it produces a 0.5 liter of water. And so once a cow learns that she, by pushing her with her nose on that black plate, you're not going to stop her no matter how hard it is. If she's thirsty, she's going to push it. And so you might as well put it in the front position where it yields the most water.
Where do you manufacture these?
Well, we have the welded hood and pendulum built in Red Deer, and then we bring those to our farm at Rimby, and we build the cylinders, we assemble the nose, the hood itself, the pendulum, and we box everything up. And at this point, everything we're marketing right off the farm here.
So, Jackie, I'll ask you a couple of questions. You're involved in the marketing side of this. Do you ever get any questions about the name of the pump?
Yeah, we do. It's always, that's always kind of a fun aspect of it, because we have people calling. Well, today someone called from Statistics Canada, and they just wanted to know what a frost-free nose pump was. And so the name does conjure up all kinds of images to people that don't even know it's associated with livestock. So it's an opportunity for us to explain what it is.
How far and wide are you marketing this?
Well, mostly in North America. We are doing marketing in Canada and the U.S. right now, and we have had some interest shown from Argentina, and that was just someone happened to see it on the internet and was very thought it would solve a problem that he had. So we're certainly welcome the world, but we're concentrating on North America.
This has really been a team effort on the part of you and your husband. What do you see as being the most important part of going through this process of developing an invention and then trying to take it out and sell it?
Probably the biggest thing is believing in what you're doing, because I think it would be pretty hard to sell something that you didn't feel good about selling. And that's one area that we don't have any trouble, because we certainly believe in what the pump will do, because we've been using it ourselves for 4 years on our own ranch. So we know it will help. It's helped us, and we know it'll help other people.
What difference has it made to you?
Well, we've been able to change some of our management practices. We are able to feed the cattle out in the remote areas in the wintertime, leave the manure out there so we don't have to haul it out later. And since we've been able to do that, we haven't treated a single calf for scours. We bring the cattle home to clean paddocks to calve and then get them right out again, and we find that's made all the difference in the world.
That's one of the things that gives us so much confidence in marketing the frost-free nose pump, is that we have a working farm here at Rimby. We have 135 cows, and we have four of these frost-free nose pumps installed in our farm at various places, and we use them for different times of the year for different reasons. But because we have our own herd, we test stuff. And we'll make a change in the nose pump, and we'll put our cows on it, and they'll use it. And if something is, you know, not working or didn't work out like we anticipated it work, we change it. And then we put our cows on it, you know, and they are our guinea pigs. And so it's not as though we're, a theoretical company. We have, our salesmen are our cows. And if our cows won't work it, I can't expect anybody else's cows to work it. But if our cows will work it, I don't see why anybody else's cows won't work it. And so that's when we go to market our nose pump, we can talk with confidence because we've done it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I was speaking with Jim and Jackie Anderson, the husband and wife team from Rimby, who have developed the frost-free nose pump for watering cattle all year round. The Alberta Conservation Association launched its new magazine recently at the Provincial Museum. Steve Hull is the managing director of the ACA.
Yeah, we find this very exciting. It's been a good day. Part of our mandate is information, knowledge, and something we firmly believe in is that knowledge creates awareness, and maybe awareness creates action. So we think it's really good that we'd be able to get the information out. Challenges facing the wildlife, the fisheries, and particularly the habitat in Alberta. The more people that know about it, the more contribution toward conservation will come out of it.
What's in this first issue?
Basically, it's a highlight comment. We've highlighted a number of the projects that have been going on. We've highlighted some of our partnership projects. We've created a feature article in there, Ask the Biologist. We're looking for interaction on that. But one of our staff is very highly credible in this field, and hopefully some of the tricky questions you can deal with as well as the standard ones. And generally a listing of what we do and why we do it to a certain extent.
Who should be getting this magazine?
Well, we'd like to see the whole province get it, the outdoor enthusiasts, the people that are hunters, the anglers, and other conservationists out there that have an interest. Anybody that would like to have the magazine, all they have to do is come through our website or our 1-800 number. We will make sure they do get a copy, and I hope they do enjoy it.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thanks, Ron.
That was Steve Hull, the managing director of the Alberta Conservation Association. Editing the new magazine, Conservation, is Sherry Fazer.
We receive a portion of hunting and licensing levies, and that totals almost $7 million annually. And we use that that money towards some of our programs, as well as through funding to some of our programs like the Grant Eligible Conservation Fund, projects through the University of Alberta, that kind of thing.
You've got a number of articles in here that look really interesting. I was looking at the table of contents, and there's one here on the pronghorns. What's happening with pronghorns?
Well, this particular article is about a project that's going on southern Alberta, on Alberta pronghorn, and it's studying the habitat conditions of pronghorn. And what they're hoping to do that through several different methods using GPS collars to track the animals. And ultimately, by improving pronghorn habitat, they'll maybe improve habitat for other grassland species.
You've also got something about stream crossings in there.
Yeah, that's our fisheries section, and that's on the different stream crossings that occur in the province and how that the effect of that on fisheries populations is not good.
That's the hanging culvert problem.
Yes, the hanging culvert is one example. They also talk a little bit about off-highway vehicle use and the problems that can pose. So looking at the different ways that ACA is studying this issue in the province.
Ask the biologist, what's that?
Ask the biologist, that's a little bit more of a fun section. Our science and research manager, Dr. Gary Scrimger, focuses on. So he has an interesting introductory piece on the importance of conservation science to conservation. And then we're starting a question and answer feature. So every issue, he'll pick an interesting question about conservation and answer it for the readers.
How can people get hold of this magazine?
This is a free magazine, and people can get a hold of it by visiting our website at www.ab-conservation.com, and there's an option to get an online subscription, or they can call our office, which is a toll-free number, which is 1-877-969-9091.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Sherry Fazer, editor for the new Alberta Conservation Association magazine. I also spoke with Steve Hull, the ACA's managing director. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, the Capital Region Innovation Centre, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, ICOR, the Informatic Circle of Research Excellence, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.